You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Shias are a Muslim sect constituting more than 60% of the Iraqi population. As the disempowered majority, they constitute the most important and the most organized opposition to Saddam Hussein's regime. This week, the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution of Iraq will be joined by Kurdish groups and the U.S.-backed Iraqi National Congress for a discussion of a post-Saddam Iraq. Khalid Sidmohan met them in the Iranian capital of Tehran.
Founded in the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1982, the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution of Iraq is the political emanation of an old and strong opposition structured by the Iraqi Shia clergy. But with the Iranian Islamic Revolution in 1978 and the call of Ayatollah Khomeini upon the Iraqi Muslims to rise up against what he called Iraq's corrupted Ba'athist socialist regime, what was a strong opposition became a serious threat. Since then, the Shia have paid as high a price as the Kurds the price of their opposition. Mr. Abu Shahab al-Ghazali, director of the Documental Center for Human Rights in Iraq, based in Tehran.
From our position as human rights watchers, we can notice very clearly that the Shia people are the most targeted people in Iraq. Most of the human rights violations are committed against them. The violations records we keep track of include the detaining of the ulemas and students of religious schools, destruction of the mosques, and general oppression of the Shia culture. But the worst, of course, was the massacre against the population perpetrated 15 years ago and the uprising that was violently repressed in 1991.
But while the Shia community has many reasons to hate Saddam Hussein and to desire to overthrow him, this organization doesn't support the war, at least officially. The organization claims to have its own solution to get rid of the dictator, Ayatollah Sayyid al-Hakim, leader of the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution of Iraq.
The best solution would be for the Iraqi people to take the responsibility to change the situation in Iraq, but they need support from the international community, and I don't mean military support. The UN didn't do the best to help the Iraqi people. It only cares about Resolution 688, which concerns the mass destruction weapons and how to pull them out of Iraq. But Resolution 687, which concerns the protection of the Iraqi people from the aggression of the regime, has just been ignored. If applied, this resolution could make the population self-confident enough to overthrow the regime itself without too many losses. We have told the people of America and many other countries about this solution, but we didn't get any convenient answers from them. We think that this project is the most favorable and may prevent other disasters from happening.
Aware of the disinterest of the Western nations and the U.S. administration in particular for their plan, they are resigned to the war, for which they don't show much hostility. When asked about its worst consequence, this is the answer of the brother of the leader, Abdulaziz al-Hakim.
The worst consequences might happen is that America may start the war and the Iraqi regime will use the people as human shields and will use also the mass destruction weapons. There will be many victims amongst the Iraqi people.
Such statements could give a green light to George Bush to wage war on Iraq, even though United Nations teams have found no evidence of weapons of mass destruction. But nevertheless, the Shia opposition is not ready to replay the 1991 screenplay. In the wake of the Desert Storm operation, the southern Shia cities of Najaf and Karbala rose up against the power, hoping to get the same support given to the Kurds' northern provinces. The expected help never shown up. The result was a terrible crackdown. Jassim Abdurrahman Mohammed, Iraqi refugee met 2 weeks ago in Turkey, yet Sunna thinks that U.S. stepped back from removing Saddam Hussein, fearing that the country would fall in the hands of Shias. He says, the U.S. administration wasn't ready to let them take the power. Not only politically and military organized with 20,000 armed men forced inside the country, They also had at their disposal the help of the neighboring Shia regime of Iran, with whom they could unify all the Shias of the Persian Gulf, which could constitute a major threat to the Arab neighbors such as Saudi Arabia, and consequently to the American interest in the region. This is enough to settle a strong and mutual suspicion between the U.S. administration and the Shias, who are the ally of Tehran, which is in the American president's axis of evil. For Pacifica Peace Watch, I'm Khalid Sidmohand in Tehran.
Well, as President Bush prepares for a so-called preemptive strike against Iraq, others are contemplating a preemptive impeachment to stop the war. Professor and international law expert Francis Boyle co-authored the impeachment resolution introduced by Texas Representative Henry Gonzalez at the start of the last Gulf War. In an interview with Mimi Rosenberg on WBAI's Wake Up Call, Boyle described the striking similarities between the grounds for impeachment of President George Herbert Walker Bush in 1991 and current efforts to remove President George Walker Bush on the verge of the second Gulf War.
When this whole crisis with Iraq started in August, it seemed to me that the Bush Jr. strategy was pretty much the Bush Sr. strategy in their last war against Iraq in the run-up starting in August 1990 straight through. Even the time frames are very much the same. So what I did was go back into my files and pull out all the documents I used to try to oppose the Bush Sr. war against Iraq. And one of the things I dusted off, of course, was the Gonzalez impeachment resolution against Bush Sr., the late, great Henry B. Gonzalez of Texas. On the Sunday after Congress voted the last time for a war against Iraq in January of 1991, Congressman Gonzalez, Ramsey Clark, and I agreed to set up a national campaign to impeach Bush Sr. if he went to war. And Ramsey asked me to do the first draft of the impeachment resolution. So I went into my office very early on a Monday morning and put this whole thing together, faxed it off to Ramsey. Mike Ratner was also involved in this effort and came up with the Gonzalez impeachment resolution, five articles that I can go through here. And it's amazing to read through the resolution itself, the five articles, and especially the eloquent speech that Congressman Gonzalez himself gave January 16th, the day after the war started. It's deja vu all over again. It's almost directly on point. All you really have to do is change the name from George Herbert Walker Bush to George Walker Bush, and it's pretty much the same thing. What happened then was on Tuesday before the war, we announced the campaign in Washington, D.C., and then here at a big rally in Champaign. And Tuesday evening, we literally had tens of thousands of people all over the country marching and chanting, "Impeach Bush, impeach Bush." But on Wednesday, he went to war. This time, we have more time. And so my approach is that the call for a preemptive war requires preemptive impeachment. We need to be able to provide resources for all the youth of America to have a secure future and not have to go into the military. And Congressman Gonzalez made that quite clear in Article 1. Article 2 dealt with bribing, threatening, and intimidating the members of the Security Council to support war against Iraq. That's exactly what Bush Jr. is doing. Indeed, again, they're following the exact same scenario, both domestically and internationally. The only major difference here, of course, is the doctrine of preemptive war, which I've consistently pointed out was rejected by the Nuremberg judgment when the lawyers for the major Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg tried to argue a preemptive war to justify some of the wars that they started during the Second World War. We have the highest level officials of the U.S. government making arguments that were rejected by Nuremberg. It's an appalling situation. Article 3 of the Gonzalez impeachment resolution, of course, dealt with the numerous war crimes that were clearly going to be contemplated by the Bush Sr. administration in the war against Iraq. And of course, this happened. As best as we were able to figure out, 200,000 people were killed, 100,000 soldiers, 100,000 civilians. And then, of course, later the sanctions estimate, maybe 1.5 million Iraqis have died, 500,000 children. And Madeleine Albright thought that was just fine. That was the price we had to pay. Well, you know, that's outright genocide. And I could take that statement that she made and file it at the International Court of Justice in support of an argument of specific intent to commit genocide against the people of Iraq, which is a component element of a successful genocide lawsuit at the World Court. What we're trying to find now is one member of Congress willing to introduce a bill of impeachment and then try to get everyone to rally behind it. As you know, Congressman McDermott has said we need 1 million people in the streets to prevent this war. And I'm just adding, and we need them all chanting impeach Bush. There's enormous opposition out there to what he and his henchmen are doing. So people are mobilizing to oppose this terrible war. As you know, the rally's coming up Saturday. And I think we need everyone there just chanting impeach Bush. He's going to get the message that we will go after him one way or the other. In the last Congress, I came within a hair's breadth of getting one member of Congress willing to introduce a revised Gonzalez impeachment resolution. But now in the new Congress, we have a committee here, very bright, intelligent, hard-driving students who are in the process of contacting the offices of every member of the House of Representatives that did not vote for the Iraq War resolution and see if we can just get one member to introduce the bill of impeachment. I think if we can do that, then we can get everyone mobilizing behind it in the country and send a message to Bush that is really going to shake him in his boots, because he knows there isn't support out there for what he's doing.
International law expert Francis Boyle on the WBAI Wake-Up Call program this morning, hosted by Mimi Rosenberg. Thanks to Peace Watch producer Robert Knight for preparing that report. The Immigration and Naturalization Service began its third special registration period on Monday. Included in Group 3 are male Pakistani and Saudi Arabian non-citizens over the age of 16. Over the weekend, the Pakistan ambassador to the U.S. joined with area Pakistani leaders in Houston, Texas, to speak out against what they're calling a discriminatory policy because of its emphasis on mostly Muslim countries. Marizia Wong attended the Pakistani Community Forum. She files this report from the Houston Independent Media Center radio program on Pacifica Station KPFT.
To relieve anxiety among the nation's second-largest Pakistani-American population, the Pakistani-American Association of Greater Houston is communicating its displeasure with U.S. treatment of community members. On Saturday, the association hosted a community forum. Present were Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S., Ashraf Qazi, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service's interim district director for the Houston area, Hippolito Acosta. Both Ambassador Qazi and Director Acosta discussed the INS registration policy affecting Pakistani men visiting, studying, and doing business in the U.S. An estimated 700 people attended the afternoon event. Mixed in with the forum's overall tone of understanding towards U.S. security concerns was a tone of trepidation towards changing immigration policies. Pakistani Ambassador Ashraf Qazi explained,
"The trauma that has been visited upon America is something that it's our duty to understand and appreciate as to why America has to give the highest priority to its national security. We, the people of Pakistan, know this and appreciate this, and as has been said today by the leaders of your community here, they, as Americans, want to give exactly the same priority. You want to give exactly the same priority to the national security of your adopted country. At the same time, we want to protect our community from any high-handedness, any unintended consequences of the application of laws which are designed to achieve one set of objectives but can inadvertently lead to other sets of consequences which may not be which are not desired.
Ambassador Qazi's expression of mixed emotions echoed the event's opening remarks by Pakistan Chamber of Commerce USA President Ashraf Abazi, who said,
"Now it is the first of time that we demand from our President, Pakistan, Musharraf, to pose President Bush in a crisp, precise, loud and clear question. Either Pakistan is America's friend or America's enemy. It cannot be both, and it cannot be in between. If Pakistan is America's friend, then why Pakistani nationals are considered risk for American security? And if Pakistan is enemy of America, then Pakistan needs to reshape its alliance and future foreign policy."
The forum was intended to answer questions about the true status of Pakistani Americans in U.S. society. But this response by INS Director Hippolyta Acosta during the question and answer session did little to reassure the community.
One question, and it says, please answer yes or no. Would a person out of status be detained?
I am not going to honor the request of yes or no. But I will tell you this. Each case, because this merits an explanation, each case requires that it be reviewed individually so we can substantiate that that individual, if he does not need to be detained, obviously this an individual in this category might be placed in proceedings, but that does not necessarily mean that person has to stay in detention.
Community distressed after December's mass detention of 400 men, mostly Iranian nationals, in Los Angeles was clearly expressed to KPFT by individual audience members. Upon learning of the station's coverage of Friday's deadline, they asked this reporter about the INS's specific registration process and whether there were any detentions. Distrust of the INS extended to even the immigration attorneys attending the forum. Attorney Syed Isfar told Acosta how he plans to advise his clients.
The deadlines are from January 13 to February 21st. Why should I tell my client, who is out of status, to go on January 3rd? My advice would be wait until February 21st. And of course, you don't want me to do that because that will create a problem for you. The reason I would advise them to wait until February 21st is because there's hope that the deadline might be extended. There's hope that the program might be repealed. So why should he subject himself early January 13th when he's out of status?
As the February deadline approaches for Pakistani and Saudi nationals to register, Pakistani-American leaders are continuing their efforts to organize their community's dealings with new INS guidelines. Their efforts include volunteer attorneys preparing to aid those who face detention. Reporting for the Houston Indy Media Center, I'm Marisha Wong.
Finally tonight, from California, we spoke to radio host, former U.S. Senate candidate, presidential candidate, songwriter, political folk singer, activist, and veteran of the Korean War, Utah Phillips. He shared with us how his experiences as a veteran of the Korean War shaped his life.
I tell you, the experience of being in Korea is what turned me into a pacifist, and the experience in Korea turned me into an anarchist. And I understand what those things mean. I joined the Army, RA19547182, sir. As we all remember our serial number, I was RA all the way. Well, like old Mrs. Stringfellow said up in Idaho, some people learn things the hard way, but then at least you never forget it. I saw a small Asian country absolutely devastated, nothing growing. I saw the men were all missing, their daughters, their wives were forced to walk the street. I saw an orphanage full of 100 GI babies living in on a 100-pound bag of rice a month, and the Korean government would acknowledge them, and the U.S. government wouldn't acknowledge them. I had a commanding officer who said that was terrible, these GI babies, but that it would eventually be good because it would raise the intelligence of the Korean people, those sorts of things. I came home, got on the freight trains for about 2 years, pretty well torn apart, pretty well torn. I didn't know if I could live in the country anymore. But then old Ammon Hennessy, the Catholic worker, got me off of the freights into the Joe Hill House in Salt Lake, one of Dorothy Day's people. And he convinced me that I loved the country with a deep and abiding passion. He said, you come in and out of town on these trains with these great songs about people and places you've been, you know you love the country, you just can't stand the government. He quoted Mark Twain, loyalty to the country always, loyalty to the government when it deserves it. I've yet to find that instance. He also convinced me that I needed to become a pacifist for the same reason an alcoholic has to give up alcohol, because alcohol will kill him. And I was acting out a lot. I was brawling a lot. And he said, you know, if you want to save your life, you're going to have to become a pacifist and learn to deal with your violence, your capacity for it every day, mm-hmm. in every situation for the rest of your life, because it's not going to go away.
You didn't feel as though there was any role that the U.S. troops were playing in Korea that you felt was important to that particular situation at that time?
No, not at all. The soldiers, and I think this is true of a lot of it, especially our interventions in small countries, we had GI compounds, we had GI villages, this old word, the rear, you know, and those compounds attracted the worst element in Korean culture, and also the most impoverished. And most GIs never got outside that village that they attracted because of their money. And they came home with the impression that that's what Korea was, that it was prostitutes, it was slicky boys, thieves. They never got past that out into the villages. And so they came home with a really distorted view of what those countries are like, what those people are like.
But, I mean, really the political situation is what I'm asking you to comment on at that time. And then, and again, here we are in dialogue internationally, or should be in dialogue internationally with North Korea again, considering the fact that they've said they're going to start, they've restarted their nuclear weapons facility building.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We keep saying we don't have any nuclear weapons down there, but hell, I know we do. The last unit I was in Korea was 663rd Field Artillery Atomic Gun, the atomic cannons. We had nuclear-armed Nike missiles down there. The U.S. says that the United States doesn't have any of the nuclear weapons there. Oh, they give them to the Korean government. So look, Russell, they can say we don't have any nuclear weapons there. We've been armed to the teeth and belligerent as hell there for, well, 50 years now, a bit better than 50 years. We could go back and hash over the reasons why that war started. I've looked into it quite deeply, you know, since I got back. But like you say, we've got to deal with the situation as it is right now. I think that I really admire this new president there in South Korea for pressing for your reunification. I think the same sort of thing can happen if we let it happen, that happened in Germany, mm-hmm. That the two can be reunified, and that can be done successfully.
Have you talked to people about this impending war with Iraq? I know you. I read where you call your music a political weapon.
You know, ma'am, I got to admit that I never wanted to be typed as a political singer because I want a general audience. You become a political singer, and if that's all you do, the only people who show up are the ones who agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I want a general audience. That's why I'm a folk singer, because the folk music audience is somewhere in the middle or maybe a little bit to the right. I want us to get to laugh and sing together and become friends, and then I can deal with the issues I want to deal with, you see. I can move us into it and then move us out of it, you see. And I can't find anybody who wants this war, you know. Walking around town, I'm in a conservative rural county here in California, Nevada County. I stop people on the street and say, I can't find anybody that wants this war.
Yeah, that's very surprising.
Well, considering that what the statistics say, yeah, the statistics are damn lies, just like Mark Twain said. And I don't believe in those statistics. I live in a town of 2,800 people here, and this big demonstration coming up on the 18th, we're sending 7 busloads down to the Peace Rally in San Francisco.
Mm.
So I think that the support for this war is paper thin. I just think that the executive branch of the government has been corporatized, and it behaves like a corporation. The people who are running this, these oil millionaires, they have no experience of democracy. Their whole life's experience has been corporate, from the corporate world and their anti-democratic institutions. So, like a corporation, they don't have to. They feel like they don't have to pay attention to us.
Hmm.
So, we have to be as loud and vociferous as we can in a nonviolent way, and goddammit, get their attention.
Why do your warships sail on my waters? Why do your death bombs fall from my sky? Why do you burn my farm and my town down? I've got an old friend, I've got to know why. What makes your ships haul death to my people? Nitro blockbusters, big cannons and guns. Why can't your ship bring food and some clothing? I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. What good work did you do? I'd like to ask you to give you my money right out of my hands. I built your big house to hide from my people. Why do you hide so? I've got to know. Why can't we spend more to build homeless shelters? Why are the homeless here anyhow? Fortunes are building on greed and on killing. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know now. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. You keep me in jail, you lock me in prison. Your hospital's jammed and your crazy house full. What made your cop hurt my unarmed peace worker? I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. My friends are dying from AIDS and from cancer. The big money goes where your death missiles fly. Built by good workers, paid by war taxes. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know.
Songwriter, storyteller, political activist, and presidential candidate, Utah Phillips. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Keith Shalijan, and Benda Berkland. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebEpic.com for web help. Copies of the program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.